two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to First Lady and Friends. This is a really unique and fun episode. I am coming to you from London, England, and I am so excited. We've been on a trade mission. We've had amazing experiences, and we are here now in London having meetings with people here on the ground, making connections through our Utah companies as well as government relationships. We are learning new things and how to do things and how we can collaborate better. And today, in that vein, I'm so excited to have a podcast here in London with Deanna Davidson, MP. She's Parliamentary Undersecretary of State, Leveling Up. And so we're going to talk about Leveling Up. I'm just learning about it. I've read about it a little bit, but welcome to the show, Deanna.
Thank you so much. No, this is really great. I think, you know, forging these links internationally is so important. So we can learn from each other, learn best practice, figure out, you know, what you guys do well, what we do well, share those learnings and all move forward together.
Yeah, I love it. It's, and as my listeners know that, you know, I love the idea of getting proximate. You have a very unique story and I can't wait to hear it. And I love the way we can share and make some connections about where we have commonality and where we can learn from each other. So let's get started. I love to get started and talk about you personally. Tell me about yourself, where you grew up, a little bit about your family, your background, all that kind of thing.
As a politician, I love talking about myself, so I'm sure this will be my favorite bit. No, so I grew up in a city called Sheffield, which used to be a huge steel manufacturing city, which saw kind of a huge decline sort of before I was born. So it was a city that needed to find its kind of new reason for existing, really. In a very kind of humble household I grew up in, you know, I guess working class would be what we'd sort of refer to ourselves as. My whole family, you know, my parents worked multiple jobs to try and see us through. And to me, it just felt like a very normal upbringing, which I guess is, you know, what everyone thinks relative to our own experiences anyway. So my mum and dad were great. My father was self-employed. He was a stonemason. And I think his kind of self-employment was a huge kind of motivator for me. The fact that he was so sort of get up and go, huge aspirations, and one of the most hardworking people I know. So that really kind of inspired me right throughout my life. And then I moved from Sheffield to Hull, which is another city based around kind of ports and sort of fishing, when I went to university to study British politics and legislative studies. Everything I do has a long title, but effectively British politics was what I studied. I was the first in my family to go to university, so that was a really kind of big step for the family, and I really enjoyed it. And then from then on, I had a bit of a slightly more unusual journey. At the age of 20, I was approved to stand as a candidate for the Conservative Party for Parliament, which at 20 is kind of crazy. It's not something that happens to many, if any, people. And at 21, I stood in a general election. And that journey has kind of continued. So, you know, they say you have to take the knocks and learn from them. I lost twice before I won, but eventually at the age of 26, I became the Member of Parliament for Fisher Portland. And I think, you know, one of the youngest sort of female MPs that we've had. So I think I'm about the third youngest, which is great. We got a really great young intake in this time around. And it's been an incredible journey, really, since then.
Wow. So you talked a lot about, you know, maybe the British Parliament, how this works. I think most of us in the US have no clue. And maybe I'm just
the feeling's probably mutual.
Okay, yeah, because it's, you know, there's some words that maybe equate and some, you know, titles that maybe we can equate. So, you know, MP, just explain maybe a little bit about what that means, because I think most of us would maybe equate it to a member of Congress. You know, not the Senate side, the House of Representatives side. I think that's maybe the comparison.
Yeah, no, that is right. So I always say if I meet sort of American delegations that I'm sort of roughly the equivalent of a congressman. Yes. And then also now as a minister, I'm sort of in the kind of sort of federal government as well, just okay. to add confusion to things. So I, you know, I'm elected by my kind of local area. They send me to legislature, they send me to parliament, and I do what I can to try and make their lives better.
Mm, yeah, that's amazing. So I want to go back to what inspired you, and you talked a little bit about your influence of your family, especially mm-hmm. your dad, and his hard work. And I can really relate to that. My dad was he worked at the bank, but he was actually a farmer. But you have to be a banker. You have to have, you know, where I am. I grew up in a little small town, but you kind of had to have a job to support your farming habit. So that's kind of how we rolled. But my dad was probably the hardest working person I ever knew, and my mom as well. And so. Talk a little bit maybe about how that informed your journey and what you wanted to do. And did you always want to do, was this the path you were aiming for?
Oh gosh, on the latter question, absolutely not. Yeah. I like most sort of young people, I went through phases. So I wanted to be a race car driver and an astronaut for a while when I was really little. Then I really wanted to become an author. And that's something that one day I'm determined to actually finish my novel and get published. And then I went through various journeys. So at one point I decided I wanted to join the police. That was something that stuck with me for a long time. And the reason for that, not to get too dark, when I was 13, my father was killed by a single punch, which is something that you kind of see on movies, but you never expect it actually happens in real life. He was out with his friends. Things got a little bit spicy. This guy threw one punch and my dad was dead before he hit the ground. So it was such a shock to the family and really kind of shaped my formative years. I think you go one of two ways when a tragedy happens. You kind of fall to pieces and go down the wrong path, or it really pulls you together and makes you incredibly determined. And thankfully, it could have gone either way. I took the second path and it made me really determined to kind of do him proud, but also to fight for justice for other people who go through similar kind of experiences. Because one of the things we know about the kind of one punch assault kind of area is that the sentencing is incredibly low. People who kind of commit these crimes will often be out of prison in sort of 18 months, which doesn't feel fair when a life has been taken. So I've decided that I wanted to do something to help other families who'd gone through that. So the police to me seemed the natural thing, because the police, the family liaison officers who'd helped my own family, were so fundamental to us getting through that really difficult time. I thought maybe this is the way that I can help others. And then totally by accident, at 16, I kind of discovered politics at school. I'd never been into politics. My family were not political. My parents had never voted. My grandparents were kind of classic swing voters. We'd never discussed politics at home. We'd never discussed it around the dinner table. We didn't have a dinner table. You know, it was sort of TV dinners, but we never discussed politics. So I kind of discovered it by accident and thought, okay, well, this is it. This is the thing that I can do. If I get involved in politics, I can help change the law on this. I can help spread awareness about this. I can, you know, try and prevent this happening to other people. And so it really drove me from then. So it's kind of incredible how one kind of small action seemingly can kind of shape your whole life, really.
Yeah, that's incredible. And what a powerful story, and the way you've overcome such a tragedy and you know, made a real path forward for yourself. I absolutely, you know, that feels very American to me. No.
I get that. And, you know, that, and you know, I think I was so influenced by my dad as such a central figure anyway. But when that happened, I really drew from the values that he kind of brought me up with. So that sense of hard work, aspiration, you know, really wanting to do the best for you and for your family and make things better for the next generation, that was really kind of what drove him. And I think that's kind of why I became a kind of British conservative, in that they, to me, were the values that I felt were best expressed, you know, the values that I'd been brought up with were best expressed by that party at the time. People often ask me that, you know, as a working class girl, why did you go that way in politics? And in Britain, sort of traditionally, that wouldn't be the way. You tend to towards the Labour Party and the other party. But yeah, it's shaped me a lot.
Yeah, talk a little bit about, I mean, I think I always love to define vocabulary that we use, define words that we use, because I find that we tend to not understand each other because we're not working from the same definitions of words. And so I see this a lot in our political discourse where, you know, I may define conservative as one thing and somebody else may define it in another way. So talk maybe a little bit about this, you know, you say conservative, to us in the U.S., it may mean something different. To us in Utah, it may mean something even more different. So maybe talk a little bit about what that means here in Britain, what that means to you personally, maybe those two ideologies.
It's really interesting because obviously there is a dictionary definition of sort of small C conservatism, which I think we would all share and kind of understand. But one of the things I love about the kind of conservative party in Britain, the sort of party that I represent, is it's a really broad church. So it comes from these values of kind of aspiration, hard work, kind of, you know, fiscal responsibility, low taxes, things that I think, you know, broadly everyone in my party would support. But actually there's a whole range of people on the spectrum. So I personally actually consider myself like really socially liberal. Mm-hmm. There are others within my party that are much more socially conservative. But the fact is we can all kind of coexist together around the same kind of core values. I get told quite a lot on social media, which is, you know, apparently the kind of font of all truth, according to some people, but I'd say the font of all abuse, I think, that I should, you know, leave my party and join the liberals because, you know, you're not really a true conservative, you're really a liberal, you know, you support LGBT rights, you support women's rights, so like, why are you here, you know, you're not a true conservative. And I think that's the thing that I always try and get across, in that our party is so broad. Mm-hmm. It's about sharing the values that we do share, really promoting them and working together to try and make the country a better place. So I hope that's helpful.
No, that's really helpful. And honestly, just I really connect with that because, you know, we maybe, you know, my husband and I kind of fall into a similar category. Mm-hmm. Where we're trying to bring people together and maybe not use language that divides, but mm-hmm. but trying to bring language in and speak in things in a way that is more brings people together, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so I love that what you're saying is that there's this place for everyone in your party. And also I love you talked about social media being the place that I find, and I'd love for you to see if this is the same here and in your experience. I find that social media makes us feel like there's an extreme voice that's more outsized than mm-hmm. it really is. I mean, it feels like this echo chamber. And when I get out and talk to actual people, I find we call it the exhausted majority mm-hmm. who don't really share those extreme ideologies, but really just want to get things done and want to, you know, love their country, love, you know, feel patriotic, but also are being disheartened by what they're seeing in the public sphere, in social media mm-hmm. and in the media, you know. And so maybe talk a little bit about, is that been your experience? Are you seeing that as well?
I think there definitely is something to be said for social media being that sort of echo chamber. And I think the problem with it is so easy to be anonymous and to say something on a screen that you would never say to someone face to face, or that you would never say over the phone or whatever. And I think that really empowers people to be strong in their beliefs, which on the one hand is a good thing, you know, but on the other hand, I think it drives off people who don't want to be abused. So the exhausted majority, as I think you just worded it, which is a great phrase, which I'm going to steal from now on. I think there are a lot of people who just don't use social media in that way. They might look at it to, you know, communicate with friends or to look at the news or whatever, but don't engage in that sort of debate and sort of narrative, which I think is really damaging. And I think also the actual technology itself is kind of really kind of set up in that echo chamber way, in that the algorithms say you like things from people who say this one particular argument. we're going to show you more things from people who say this one particular argument, and suddenly kind of organically it grows into that echo chamber. You know, there are so many times when I have said Twitter is not real life.
Yes.
You need to get out there and speak to real people. You know, not only are there loads of people who just don't use social media, there are lots who will watch and not say. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's an important tool. It's an important tool for communicating. I think as a politician, it's important to be on it, to broadcast and publish and tell people what you're up to. I tend not to use it so much for going back and forth, because I think all it does is wind everyone up rather than actually bringing any kind of light to any arguments. But I think, yeah, no, I really like exhaust the majority. That's really good.
Yeah, no, and I think when you hear that, everyone feels it. They're like, yes, we are exhausted. I want to continue talking about this, and especially what you're up to with Leveling Up, and we'll do that when we come right back.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent. It was senseless. And I will never understand it. I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to First Lady and Friends. We're here with Deanna Davidson, MP, Parliament Undersecretary of State, Leveling Up. I want to talk about Leveling Up. Our delegation is here to meet and learn more about this, and we're thrilled about it. We love what you're doing. Again, young politician, conservative politician that is doing some really powerful work here, and something that we really connect with. In my initiative and Show Up, we are doing a lot around the most vulnerable. You know, we really want to make sure that they have a voice, and really, you know, so I do things with unified sports, with the Special Olympics. It's where my heart is. I love it so much. With foster care, with our foster families and our educators, our teachers. These are populations that I feel sometimes don't have the voice and maybe aren't, you know, being listened to and helped in the way that I want to help them. So, talk a little bit about how we connect with it. I think Leveling Up is that same sort of idea. Where are the folks that need us the most, and how do we help them? So maybe talk a little bit what it is, all the things about it.
Well, it's so important. So I get asked as sort of Leveling Up minister all the time, yeah, but what does Leveling Up really mean? And to me, it works because it's so simple, and the simplicity in it is effectively that no matter where you are born, no matter what kind of family you come from, no matter your race, your gender, your sexuality, you should have the same opportunities as everyone else to get on in life. Whether you make it is down to you, it's down to your hard work and what have you, but those opportunities should be there. And we know in Britain that it's a very unequal society. There is huge inequalities between different regions, between sort of towns and cities. And so we recognise that we really needed to do something about that. And to me, it's been something that's really driven me sort of ever since I was young, and I came from very humble beginnings. I was very lucky. I won a scholarship to a private school. I saw a lot of my friends go to the sort of less good schools nearby, and the different opportunities that I had versus them, to me, never seemed fair. So it's sort of really driven me in this role to really try and do something about it. So last year, my department published what we call the Leveling Up White Paper, which effectively is kind of our roadmap to achieving better equality, I guess, better equality of those opportunities. And it brings in all kinds of things. So it's about health, it's about education, it's about pay, it's about productivity, it's about transport, because if there are good jobs but you can't get to them, what's the point of them being there, right? So it's sort of working, not just in my department, but right across the government, not at national level, at kind of local level, to really bring together our best ideas and try and close some of these gaps. It is a big mission.
Yes.
It is going to take time. Our white paper sort of takes us to 2030, and we've sort of set out key missions, towards 2030 that we're making really good progress on. But we've got a long way to go. And everyone has different ideas about how this should work, which is great. But I think the important thing is, I think, you know, right across politics, so whether you're, you know, Labour or Conservative or Democrat or Republican, I think we all address this something, recognise, apologies, this is something that we need to address. And it's good that there's that sort of unity. It's just about finding unity on exactly how we do it.
Yeah. So what's the, what kind of pushback? I mean, clearly you're getting pushback, and especially I would guess, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, from your own party. You know, in our conservative politics in the U.S., it's really hard to get even your same party to agree that that this is an issue, and this is where we should put resources. This is what we should do. We're having a lot of debates, and maybe you are too, around you know, the equity and opportunity, and that's where we are. You know, as an administration in Utah, we're all about we don't guarantee equal outcomes, mm-hmm. but what we want to do is give equal opportunities.
Absolutely.
So maybe talk a little bit about the struggles that you're seeing.
So I think politically we're in a relatively good place. As I say, there's sort of cross-party unity on this as an agenda that we should be following. And in my own party, it was right at the forefront of our manifesto back in 2019. So the manifesto on which I was elected, and all of my colleagues indeed were elected, levelling up was right at the forefront in those exact words. You know, we will do what we can to level up the country, which is great. The question is, how do we do it?
Yeah.
And that's where there are sometimes some disagreements. And that could be things like, do we prioritise urban inner cities? Do we prioritize rural areas? Every area has its own challenges, right? And so that prioritization is really difficult, because everyone can make an incredibly good case. There are areas that on paper may look, you know, more wealthy, but actually they've got huge challenges with productivity or with transport, whatever it might be. So our challenge is to try and address it in the right sort of way. I wouldn't say that we've got all the answers. I wouldn't say we've got everything right, but certainly at every step of the way, we try and refine what we're doing to make it work better and to make it work for the most vulnerable and to make it work for the most deprived. And it's hard, so it's, but I think sometimes the challenges that are the most important are the toughest, but that shouldn't put you off trying to address them.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, there's so much that we do around that idea that, you know, I hear people say with our foster care situation in the U.S. And especially in Utah, we actually have less foster kids per capita than most of the states. And so for us, it's like, how do we address that? It seems impossible. And to me, it's like, how do you stop the abuse? How do you get upstream of why they're having to be removed? Mm-hmm. What are the drug issue? I mean, there's so much that you can look at, but you have to start somewhere.
Absolutely.
You have to start somewhere. And people, you know, we can be, you know, it's the Mother Teresa. It's the, you know, like, why are you doing this? And, well, I'm going to help one individual at mm-hmm. a time. So talk maybe a little bit about your motivation. How do you keep motivated when it gets tough and, and when you get the criticism and the hard things?
Because it's so important. It's what we have to do, right? I think anyone who is minded to kind of go into public service, you do have this sort of mentality that you've just outlined there, that, you know, if you can help one person, that's where it starts. You help one, then you help two, then suddenly it's 10, and, you know, then it's a whole community. I think it's that. It's kind of the individual stories, I think, that kind of keep you going, the individuals that you've helped. So, you know, I could talk a big game about how many billion pounds we've put into projects over here, but what does that mean? Because that means nothing to the person on the ground. What it means to the person on the ground is, they were really struggling with access to disabled play facilities for their children. Mm-hmm. And we gave some money to a park in Northern Ireland that has now got disabled play facilities that their kids can use. That's the story that really makes this stuff worthwhile. And as a kind of constituency member of parliament with my own kind of constituents, it's the individuals that you manage to help. It's the person who, you know, their family member had a terminal illness and they were trying to do one last holiday and their passport didn't come back in time. And we helped them get that passport. Mm. It came sort of 24 hours before their holiday, which is very stressful, but it's that, it's those stories. And, you know, despite all the abuse, despite the stress, despite the hard work of it, you are so motivated by those individuals and the people that you're actually able to help. Yeah. And so, you know, you help individuals and then suddenly you can pull together a plan of how to help more individuals. And then suddenly you're helping the community and then just build on it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's easy. And some days you wake up and, you know, you do have moments where you think, oh my gosh, why am I doing this? Yes. Oh, wow. But then one of those stories happens again, one of those things happens again, and suddenly the motivation's right back there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. So maybe talk a little bit about specific parts of leveling up that you're working on. I know housing is one of them. Maybe talk a little bit about those specific areas in the way that leveling up is going forward.
There is so much. I could sit here for like 2 hours and give like a full on TED talk about this.
Yeah.
So as I said, we set out our sort of framework to look at the different factors. So pay, productivity, transport, et cetera. And it's kind of how do we best facilitate that? So every minister has their own slice and every minister is expected to contribute to this, given it's a whole government agenda. For me, a big part of what I do is around kind of redevelopment and regeneration. So we have some funds available that are going out to places all over the country to try and redevelop their town centres. You know, we know that high streets have had a really hard time of late with COVID and moved towards kind of online shopping, which is a very convenient, good thing in many ways, but actually for our high streets, it's not been that beneficial. So we're doing a lot of work on there to try and breathe new life in through, you know, putting in cash to help redevelop, reshape, put in new technologies, etc. Bring in more business support as well. You know, I don't think government money should be spent for the sake of it. It's about using government money to leverage private investment as well so that everyone's working together for the same goals. We are doing stuff around housing redevelopment as well, but both in terms of, you know, building new houses because we need them, but also redeveloping places that that kind of just need that help, places that were built many years ago and really need some support, be it on energy efficiency or what have you. There's a lot going on. I could talk about way more. I really could. I don't want to go too in-depth because we would be here for hours. But safe to say, you know, we are really committed to this as an agenda, and it's going to take time. We recognize it's going to take time, but I'm so excited to be a part of it.
Oh, good. I love that you're, I mean, I feel like we've got to start somewhere, and I feel like, you know, you talked about that you came in with maybe a younger cohort of MPs that are working on this. I think it's time for a new generation of folks to start working on the problems. You know, what are you seeing in terms of maybe the young people? Are you seeing that? Is there a push for maybe some different policies as it relates to the things you're working on? I think we certainly are in Utah. We're the youngest state in the nation, so we feel like there's an energy to maybe move some things forward that haven't been happening or you know that aren't working well. So maybe talk a little bit about that.
Well, I always find it baffling that people say young people aren't interested in politics.
Mm.
They might not say they're interested in politics. They might not follow every twist and turn of the Senate or the Congress or whatever. They are interested in issues, and issues, every issue is political, right? So they might be interested in climate change. They might be interested in, you know, local jobs and skills or education or tuition fees or whatever it might be. Young people are really interested in politics. They might just not have converted it in their mind to politics. And I think that's something that I find so fascinating. You know, you see things on, you know, TikTok, probably the youngest sort of social media channel that we have. Kids are talking about political stuff day in, day out. They really want to make change. And it could be on any issue. I you know, you see a lot on TikTok around LGBT rights, which is an issue that I'm very passionate about, where people do want to make things better. They want to make kind of, you know, that whole sort of young, naive, I want to make the world a better place. But they do. They really do. And we really need to harness that. And I think it was actually incredible in the election in 2019, where I was elected to see, I think there were 10 MPs under the age of 30, which doesn't sound many in a sort of a body of 650. But actually, that's huge compared to what we would normally see. People with, you know, great energy and new ideas, and you need experience. You need people who've lived and have that sort of long-term business experience, legal experience, whatever it may be. But you also need young people with fresh ideas, fresh thinking, and actually who understand technology, because we know that's a bit of an issue sometimes amongst older generations too.
Indeed.
And just different ways of communicating as well. So I have had kind of both positive and negative feedback on my kind of use of social media. Mm. When I first got elected, I was very active on it because I felt it was a really good way to communicate with different audiences, which is something that we need to do. Because if I can convince young people who care about an issue that actually you could help shape that if you get interested in politics,
yeah,
that's going to bring in more people with fresh ideas, which I think can only ever be a good thing.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, I see it with my own kids that are, you know, 20 somethings right now, my older ones, and just they are very interested. They don't want to have anything to do with politics. as far as
they've been put off, dare I ask?
Oh, you just a little bit, you know, when they've watched their dad go through a really hard political election and, you know, they see the social media, they see the things that are said and put on there about their family. But also they get frustrated. You're exactly right. I mean, my kids are very frustrated with things that are going on, and they're very passionate also, like you, around LGBTQ rights issues and things like that. So they're very, they do care about a lot of issues. And I think it's important for us to have that perspective. I love talking to my kids about all kinds of issues. This has been such a great conversation. I want to continue the conversation. I was thinking you mentioned something about different communities being impacted by COVID and the way we move forward. I want to go back to COVID, and I'll do that when we come right back. We're back here on First Lady and Friends with Deanna Davidson, MP, Parliament Undersecretary of State, leveling up.
It's a nice, short, snappy title.
Yes. I've noticed that here. You guys have great titles. They're very descriptive, so we love it. I always feel weird because people always introduce me as First Lady. I'm like, please just call me Abby because it feels weird.
I get that.
It's been such a great conversation. Thank you again for taking the time. But I want to go back to this idea of COVID. I don't think we can, I mean, there's going to be research, there's going to be books, there's going to be so much written on COVID. To me, it's one of those things that I don't think we're ever going to fully, or at least not for a really long time, fully understand the effects that it's had in every aspect of our lives. And that it's global. You have incidents, you have things that happen. I mean, even maybe 9/11 could be one of those that was sort of global, but it really was the U.S. It happened on our soil. It didn't really happen to anybody else. It, you know, affects a lot of the things that happened thereafter, but I mean, there's really nothing like it, that every person basically on the globe was affected in some way. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, it's wild. And not just every person, but every community, the way we do things, the way, you know, we move forward. But let's maybe talk a little bit about, you know, what you're seeing in your communities. We saw it certainly in the U.S. and in Utah, we saw the pulling apart of physically, clearly, but emotionally, mentally, we're wired for connection, and there's some trauma in our communities. So maybe talk a little bit about what you're seeing.
It's difficult. And as you say, I think we still haven't in any way seen the full effect yet. It was just terrible, wasn't it? I mean, the uncertainty at the beginning when this thing was kind of coming, but we weren't really sure what it was, how bad it would be, the fear that you might catch this thing and that might be it, you know?
Yeah.
Because we just didn't know. It was so novel and new. And the speed at which I think it swept through the entire world was terrifying. Lockdown was really hard. If you could go back, I guess, 4 or 5 years and say, you know, the Prime Minister or the President would be on the TV saying, stay in your house, do not see your family, do not see your friends, only go out to buy essentials or whatever, I would have said you were mad. You know, I'd have said that will never happen. You know, in both our societies, freedom is right at the heart of what we do, right? So to be told you can't leave your own home was crazy, but absolutely the right thing at the time because we didn't know how dangerous the thing was, right? Yeah. There's going to be a lot of lessons learned. And right now, our COVID inquiry has just started in Britain to kind of look into things that went well, things that didn't go well, so that we can learn lessons in case, touch wood, heaven forbid, anything like this happens again, which is absolutely the right thing to do, right? In terms of my own community, I mean, it was hard. And we heard some incredibly harrowing stories from my own constituents, things that they faced, you know, not being able to see loved ones where they were on their last days, missing funerals, etc. It was horrendous. But in amongst the kind of crippling darkness of it, there were these points of light, which was communities coming together in a way that I don't think I've ever seen on such a scale before. So, you know, we had businesses that, you know, the profit-making businesses, takeaways, restaurants, etc., who completely shifted their business model. So they weren't actually selling to the general public, but they were going and delivering meals to people in hospitals and taking meals to doctors and frontline kind of staff like police, just to make sure they were fed in amongst all the crazy hours they were working. We saw that. We saw people making a list of their elderly neighbours so that they could go and do shopping for them. We saw donations of all kinds of things, you know, food, nappies, whatever it might be, just to try and support their neighbours. And it happened on a really kind of organic scale, which was amazing, because often these things take coordination. Often there has to be like that one large voice who says, I'm going to fix all this, and you know, we'll have a database or a network or a spreadsheet, whatever. It just happens. Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of the kind of real rays of light that I hope we don't lose post-COVID, in that, you know, communities really did come together. You helped your neighbour, not because you needed to, but because it was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And because we were all in that together. And I think one other kind of, if I can call it a ray of light, but one positive to have come from it, is our kind of move towards digital and kind of Zooming, which I think has made so much possible that wouldn't have been possible before. I've attended conferences all over the world now on Zoom, which I would never have done before because the technology, though it existed, we didn't really use it. Yeah. So I think there are opportunities that have come from that too. But the aftermaths, I mean, you know, things like education is probably one of the areas where I'm kind of the most concerned. I mean, we are doing a lot to try and help people catch up. Kids miss a lot of time in classrooms. So we need to do all we can to try and help them sort of catch up and recover their education. Not for the sake of passing exams, but because it's the right thing to do, that they're well educated for the sake of their, you know, future life and stuff. And I think some of the kids who had it hardest were those who were kind of right towards the end of school, maybe going to go on to university, to college, who not only missed out on all the kind of leaving school prom kind of events, but then also their first year of college was completely tainted by this because they were stuck in their rooms and stuff. I think emotionally and mentally, they're probably some of the people who've had the hardest time because they are such important formative years that were just completely sort of taken away and disrupted. Now, we are a resilient people, as I know the Americans are. And I think the way that we've kind of got through COVID has been remarkable. But there is still a lot, I think, that we will see. And the education is the one that really worries me.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, in Utah, thankfully, I mean, it was crazy for us because states were kind of doing different things based on what I thought was crazy is in the beginning, it was like everybody's all hands on deck. And then it became, again, political. Like,
everything's politics.
Everything is political. And I just, to me, that was the disheartening part, is that I felt that people were unmoored. Mm-hmm. And when we're feeling unmoored, we have to do something to explain it or to make us feel better, because we need to latch onto something. We need to feel stable. And we were all completely unmoored and unstable. And I think because we had social media, I think it was easy to go to those ideological corners. And what we saw, and I don't know if it was quite as pronounced here, but it was sort of a unity thing at the beginning, and then it was like, okay, I don't believe in this, I don't believe in that, I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to wear a mask, I don't want to get the vaccine, you know, all the things. Versus, yes, you have to. No, you know, you're evil if you don't. You know, it's this. Yeah. It's this. It was a crazy thing. Not to mention, there was, you know, then we had George Floyd was murdered, and so there was this civil. It became, I think, because people were so, I don't know what another word for it is, unmoored, fearful, just feeling like the ground was shaking under you, and you didn't know how to, you know, what was up, what's down. I think there was a lot to that, and I think people sort of grabbed on to some political pole, some political flag, to explain what was happening and to make sense of it. Did you see that here as much?
Hard to say. I mean, I think in the early stages, less so in this country, and that, you know, all our political parties kind of came together to try and tackle this, informally rather than formally, but even so. I think later down the line, though, when the vaccine was kind of being rolled out, we did see this kind of slight polarization of, as you rightly said, people who were completely did not want to take the vaccine, which is their, you know, their rights, and those who would really demonize those people for making that choice, which was really difficult, because ultimately the goal is to try and beat this pandemic, right?
Yes.
So we're all in this same goal together. And again, it comes to the point I made earlier about trying to bring us all together. We have one common goal. So it was quite difficult. But I think broadly, we were kind of okay. I'm looking around to the people in the room. I don't see anyone shaking their head or looking suspiciously at me. I don't think there was kind of as much polarization more broadly, but certainly on those sort of freedom issues, on vaccines, masks, there was a bit of that.
Well, I think probably ours was a perfect storm because we were also in the middle of a presidential election.
Yes.
So, I mean, we were in the middle of our, we were in our election. Mm-hmm. We were in our campaign. And it was, you know, we had political opponents almost wanting us to fail because my husband was a lieutenant governor at the time, almost wanting us to fail in whatever measures we were taking so that, you know, we would be damaged politically. And that was really difficult. And I think we saw that in the presidential election. Mm. We saw it in our election. So I think that was maybe the perfect storm of awfulness, I guess.
I get that. And I do feel, it's hard for me to say because I've never been president at, try and get my words out. I've never been present in the States during either, you know, midterms or a presidential election or not. It does feel like your elections are much more polarized than ours. Mm-hmm. Ours can get a teeny bit nasty, but I think if you were to translate that into the States, it'd be totally disregarded as being polite. Right.
Yes. And we can learn a lot from our friends in the UK. We can learn a lot from, you know, that at least being able to have these conversations. My husband and I are actually, my husband will be the head of the National Governors Association mm-hmm. come July, and we are going to work all on healthy disagreement. That's going to be the initiative that we're going to work on because I think in the U.S. the political problems are exacerbated by the fact that we literally have stopped talking to each other in constructive ways usually at all. And if we are talking to each other, there's a lot of contempt, a lot of vitriol. And so it's become dangerous, I think, to our country. So we're trying to figure out what we do because I feel like the state's governors are kind of a real powerful bipartisan group that can maybe start to work through some of this stuff. I want to go back before we end. I want to go back to something we talked about a little bit, but I want to see if there's some similar things that you're seeing with social media as it relates to young people and mental health. So talk to me about that. What we're seeing in the research is that really that 2011-12 time when iPhones and social media really became, you know, part of everybody's lives, mm-hmm. and young people started getting on it earlier and earlier, and the research we're seeing is a lot of connection between negative mental health or poor mental health and social media use. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing that? Is it being addressed? In fact, this last legislative session in Utah, we passed two laws that will address the way social media companies can target minor children. Mm-hmm. And so in an effort to really try to address the algorithms that you talked about, targeting our young people. It's one thing if you're, you know, an adult and you're, you can say, well, I know they're targeting me, or, you know, you've figured out the algorithm. I mean, you say something, I'll probably get 25 ads from, you know, the UK and all that. But do you know what I mean? Like having that, are you seeing that? And is it a concern here, especially as you talk about leveling up?
I think it's a huge concern. And I find it really interesting because I was kind of, I think my first social media I got when I was about 13 on Bebo, mm-hmm. if anyone remembers Bebo, that was a while back now. And so I feel like I'm part of the generation that really kind of started with, I don't want to say limited technology. I mean, we had like PlayStations and stuff, but we didn't have that sort of social networking thing. And then that came in when we were teenagers and became dominant as a part of our lives. And now as an adult, it's kind of, it's so central to kind of my job and what I do and stuff. Mm-hmm. Having not had the technology and now being so kind of dependent on it, I think is really damaging, actually. It's fascinating as a kind of academic study, a fascinating topic. But, you know, I think about things like body image, particularly for young women, but for young men too. Seeing these kind of perfectly airbrushed, gorgeous girls on Instagram or what have you. Yeah, you look yourself in the mirror and then feel like crap, don't you?
Yes.
Because I'm like, why don't I have her tummy? What is going on here? Or, you know, my boobs don't look like that, whatever it might be. It is so easy at that age when you have so many hormonal changes happening anyway to really kind of look at that and not feel good enough. Mm-hmm. And then, as we talked about the abuse, people can say things anonymously. They can comment in ways that they would never to your face. You know, I'm a huge Taylor Swift fan, and she says, you need to calm down. You know, say it in the street, that's a knockout. You say it in a tweet, that's a cop out. And that is so right, because people would not say stuff like that to your face, but it affects you. And I think particularly when you're younger, if you're, you know, a teenager and are already trying to find acceptance and trying to find your place in this world, to be told by some random stranger on the internet, you're not good enough, you're ugly, whatever it might be, and worse in many cases. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know how many comments I've seen on young people's profiles, you know, saying like things like kill yourself. Like, why would you say that to someone?
Crazy.
And then if someone's already struggling with mental health issues anyway, who knows if that's the tip that might send them completely over the edge. So I really worry about it. And I really struggle with this from a kind of ideological perspective, in that I am such a kind of freedom lover. I don't like restricting business. I don't like the thought of kind of restricting the internet and regulating the internet too much, because I think it's a great opportunity for freedom and democracy online, right? And yet I also see the damaging impact that it has on not just young people, but particularly young people. And so it's trying to find that right balance, isn't it, between putting in place the right sort of protections and measures while still allowing that freedom and that creativity to thrive. I don't know what the answer is, but it does worry me. And, you know, my eldest godkid is now 13. He's on social media. He doesn't use it that religiously yet, but I know he will. And I sort of become that fuddy-duddy where it's like, yes, I was using it at your age, but I don't think you should be using it yet and whatever. And it's, you know, massive hypocrite that I am. But I think if I, you know, had kids of my own, I would be so conscious, and I would be that crazy mum who is just monitoring everything that they do in a way that really frustrates them, but in a way that is really trying to look out for them. It worries me hugely, and we are having conversations here at the moment around how best we regulate it. We're having conversations around AI as well, and how we kind of use that for good and try and not allow it to be used for kind of harm. Fascinating topic, and, you know, there are so many great academic writings on it, but I think just the impact on people is huge. But I still love social media.
Yeah, I know. I know
it today.
No, it's really hard. It really is. I mean, we have those same conversations. You know, for us, it's more the young people. I mean, you know, we don't, you know, I don't know all the laws here, so I probably shouldn't speak. But, like, we don't allow young people to drink alcohol. We don't allow them to smoke. We don't allow, because we know there's some harm for young people. And then adults can make those decisions for themselves. Yeah. But, you know, for us, it feels like the research is getting to a point where we're not only just seeing correlation between, you know, self-harm and depression and anxiety, but we're seeing a causation. There's some studies recently there that are showing causation. And so at that point, you feel like, you know, we've done this great experiment on our kids' brains, and you know, they're just not at a place where they can, you know, logically work through it. Anyways, it's just been a really hard, because again, we're a very conservative state. We're a very conservative people. We don't also want to do that. But at the same time, we feel like, you know, we did this with drug opioid companies. We've done this with, you know, a lot of different companies where we're saying, no, you do know the effects. You do know the harm, and yet you're still targeting young people. Yeah. So how do we... It's a tough one to work through.
It's so hard. I mean, there are studies that show the kind of sort of dopamine impact that are very similar to opioid use, which is crazy to think that the chemical impact in your brain of regularly using social media and then the withdrawals when you're taken away from it is similar to using like heavy drugs. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And so part of me thinks maybe we should start thinking about it in that way. Mm-hmm. But again, finding that balance between freedom and kind of doing what's kind of right is so hard.
Yeah, it really is. It's a tricky one. I think, you know, our U.S. Congress is, you know, putting forth some of these ideas, and there may be some, you know, holding. I mean, we held tobacco companies responsible. We've done some of these things. So we feel like, you know, it's not unprecedented. It just feels unprecedented with this because the technology is new.
Yeah, and that's so, another reason to get more young people into politics.
That's exactly
right. Well, we sort of understand the technology. Yes. And, you know, you see sessions sometimes. I mean, we see them in Britain when there are sort of evidence sessions at select committees and things where some of the questions asked, you can tell the person doesn't really understand what on earth they're talking about. They're asking this question of this tech giant, but I have no clue what they're asking and no clue what the answer means. It's just another reason why I think getting young people involved is really important, because they can really help us on this journey.
That's exactly right. I think we all saw some of those, you know, Facebook executives before the US Congress, and we were all like, oh, shoot, don't ask that.
I was careful to say select committees, that's so right. Not to comment on that. But yeah, no, some of the questions were interesting. I'll put it that way.
No, that was so great. Well, I love finding the commonalities. I love finding ways that we connect and just... I go throughout the world. Like I said, I've been on a long trade mission. We've been on several, and I just find that humans are humans wherever we go, and we have the same needs, we have the same desires. And you know, we do, one thing that we've been working on a lot is this, and I've been specifically thinking about belonging. Mm-hmm. And I think, as you know, it relates to our conversation about social media, belonging is a need, an absolute need for every human. Mm-hmm. We need to have belonging. Now, whether we find that belonging in really healthy ways and ways to connect, if we get involved in politics and we find our belonging there, or if we're not going to find it there, and if we don't have opportunities to find it there, we will find it in unhealthy ways.
Yeah.
We will find it in hate. And that's what's scary to me. Mm-hmm. So I love what you're doing. I love the leveling up. I think that's a way that we share this idea of bringing communities together and making sure that everyone has opportunities. So thank you for what you're doing. And we're following it closely, and we love to connect. And if you're ever in Utah, we'd love to have you.
Oh, I'll make it happen.
Yes, perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope in Darkness on kslpodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.